Hey, Paul.
Byron, how are you?
I'm fine. Now, we've been instructed to introduce ourselves, our
That's
name,
right.
Our publication.
That's right. The new corporate overlords at Blogging Heads TV now have forced us into a tight format, and the format requires that I say that I'm Paul Glastras, editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, a left-of-center publication biased in favor of lefties.
And this is as if we were not household names, which is kind of offensive to begin with. And I am Byron York with National Review Magazine, which is the nation's oldest, most venerable, best-known conservative magazine. So many things I say will be from a conservative
point of view. I'll be talking from a liberal point of view.
Okay. Now, given all that, I think the first thing we're going to talk about is presidential politics with the Republican race. And the thing that everybody is talking about now is this new Mike Huckabee ad, the Christmas ad.
I have not seen it. I read about it in the New York Times, and I read your very fine piece on it in National Review. Unlike yourself, I've not been traipsing around Iowa. So tell us what's in the ad.
Well, it's worth 30 seconds of your time, I'll tell you. The ad is very, very simple. It's simply Huckabee in front of a Christmas tree in a red sweater with Silent Night playing softly in the background. And he says, look, I know you're just getting so many of these political commercials today, and I'm sure you're tired of it, and I don't blame you, so I just want to talk about what really matters. And at this time of year, which is the celebration of the birth of Christ, and I want to wish you all a Merry Christmas and good times with your friends and family. Something to that effect. And this has struck many political analysts, including me, as a pretty brilliant campaign commercial for a couple of reasons.
Well, it's happening at a time, right, where Mitt Romney is running harshly negative ads.
That's right. That's exactly right. This is first of all, the ad is beginning to run in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. And what happened was the Huckabee people, as Huckabee's campaign manager, Chip Saltzman, explained to me last night, they were looking at two related problems. And one is, how do you make an ad that gets any traction or that helps you politically during the Christmas season, where you don't really want to be overtly political? They think that basically all of the actual Christmas shopping and the ads and the parties and, you know, the general hubbub of the season kind of will drown out political considerations for a couple of weeks. So how do you do an ad that cuts through that? And then the other thing is, how do you respond to the negative ads that Mitt Romney has been kind of pushing since he fell behind to Huckabee in Iowa? And the answer they came up with was, why don't we sit the governor down and wish everybody a Merry Christmas? And he did, and it does a couple of things. One, it, I guess, reinforces the, I guess, what you'd call Christian branding.
Well, that's the interesting, one of the interesting things that struck me about the ad that I read about. And it really, I'm not a kind of, you know, war on Christmas guy. I like saying Merry Christmas, and I'm a big Christmas guy. But even for me, it struck me as stepping a little bit outside the bounds of the ecumenicism that we approach Christmas with. Well, we talk about Merry Christmas, you know, but we don't say we're celebrating the birth of Christ. That's just sort of a step too far, because not all of our friends and neighbors are Christians. But he does very deliberately, it seems to me.
Well, he does. I think he walks up to the line. I mean, you know, if one side of the line is saying Happy Holidays, and the other side of the line is we mark the birth of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, he's kind of pushing on the Christ side of it. On the other hand, you know, I asked Chip Saltzman about this, and he said, look, that's what Christmas is about. We say Merry Christmas. It's not exclusionary to say Merry Christmas. And that's what we're saying.
Right, but don't you think there's a difference between Merry Christmas and we celebrate the birth of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ?
I think that it takes it one step farther in this kind of Christian branding that Huckabee has
done. It seems, by the way, to me like it will work. I'm not saying it won't work.
Well, it look, I think at the same time it does the Christian branding, it also softens it a little bit by wishing everyone a Merry Christmas. And the other thing is that it does do indirectly, without saying so at all, is it does plug into this whole war on Christmas thing, which pops up every year, very popular with conservative audiences. And there are, you know, a number of people who feel that the whole sort of happy holidays, secularization of Christmas has gone a little bit too far. And they feel like they ought to be able to say Merry Christmas. And if those people happen to be in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, you know, I think they're hearing what they want to, you know, what they like to hear from Huckabee.
And what this really is a battle for relatively conservative, very activist Republican caucus goers, which is a very narrow subset of the United States population.
Well, it is a battle for them, but it's also a way of trying to do it without turning off other voters.
Right.
And my guess is, I mean, I don't know. I went to look at the exit polls from the 2004 election, the national exit polls, and I think 81% were either Protestant or Catholic. And I'm sure Huckabee is saying, we're not going to offend those people. I mean, maybe it's not their cup of tea. Maybe they think it goes a little too far. But we're certainly not going to offend those people. And the people for whom the ad is targeted will actually like it a lot. So the other part of this ad is hitting Romney in a very positive sort of way. There's a kind of a turn the other cheek, to keep our religious thing going, turn the other cheek nature to the ad. And the other thing is that this is probably an ad that Romney could not make. Not because Mormons do not celebrate Christmas. You can go to the LDS.org website and look at look at various Mormon leaders' writings on Christmas, but that Romney would probably not make an ad like that because it would
highlight his Mormonism, which is not what he's.
It would highlight all sorts of stuff he doesn't want to highlight. So, I think that this is an ad that he just.
Yeah. So, he's already a Huckabee leading in Iowa, right?
Yes, he is.
And so I think this is probably a devastating blow to Romney.
Well, it's a very clever ad, and the last thing I can talk about sort of from an inside baseball point of view is that this is maybe an inside football would be better. This ad, when you look at the three or four ads that Huckabee has done, the Chuck Norris ad, the Christian Leader ad, this ad, the other guys, I mean, the ads are not anything like the others. And the other team, in this case Romney, I think they have no idea what is coming next, nor do I for that matter. But it's like Huckabee is his quarterback who is just flummoxing the other team by calling this play or that play, and they never quite know what's coming next. So, you know, I have to say that Huckabee's conducting a rather brilliant campaign up till now with no money. Now he does have some money. He was in Beverly Hills, by the way, I think last night, raising money. I'm assuming that was at something arranged, a private home arranged by Chuck Norris.
Well, let me ask you a question about Huckabee that I have not heard anyone. It's a theory of mine. It could be completely wrong, but here it is my theory nonetheless. And that is that, you know, the people say, well, people didn't realize what a juggernaut Huckabee is. I'm not sure that's true. Most reporters that I know who were covering this campaign from the earliest days were impressed with Mike Huckabee and his speaking style and his genuineness. I know I was, and on this Blogging Heads TV was talking about months ago. So I think reporters understood that the man had potential, especially in a relatively weak Republican field. It seems that what happened is the voters switched. And my theory about what happened with the voters is that what you're seeing with Huckabee is a predominantly evangelical Christian vote that a couple of months ago was bottled up by the leadership of the Christian right, people like Dobson and so forth, having ignored Huckabee as somebody who wasn't right on economic issues with the Republican sort of K Street machine that they were allied with, and also was felt to be not electorally serious, not somebody who could win. And so they withheld, these leaders did, their endorsement of Huckabee and tried to figure out who among the top-tier Republican candidates, Giuliani or Romney, they could go for.
Well, Giuliani was always
off the table.
That's
right. But I mean, they were struggling with one of these top tier guys, could never really decide. And eventually the rank and file, which is not very happy with the Washington leadership of the movement these days anyway, for a variety of reasons, said, to heck with you, we're going with the guy who's one of us.
I think there's something to that. I would stress the bottom-up part of your theory because, I mean, this is a battle for the hearts and minds of these people in Iowa. I think it was in the Washington Post yesterday. There was a story about how Huckabee had been helped by a network of homeless.
That's right. I saw that
Iowa.
Story.
And the photo inside the jump on the article was a picture of two women, and it said that one of them had made her own campaign materials.
Right, cutting out photos and putting them on, gluing them on paper. And
now this is the kind of thing that Mitt Romney has to pay people to do. This is the kind of sort of volunteer enthusiasm versus paid staffer stuff that Romney has, for all of his strengths, there's something about him that makes people a little cautious.
Right.
Yeah, either that he's too slick, or that he appears to want it too badly, or that he has changed his opinions a lot. There's something that makes them hesitate a little bit. And Huckabee, in the short run, I mean, nobody's voted yet, but Huckabee in the short run has been much more appealing. And I was out there, I guess, I did a piece for National Review as a cover piece in August. I went out there for the straw poll, which is really what kind of made Huckabee a viable candidate out there, because as you remember, a number of the bigwigs, Giuliani and McCain, had skipped the straw poll. Romney had spent $1 zillion on it. We knew he was going to win, so it was a battle for second place, and a lot of people thought that Sam Brownback was going to get that second place spot and that Mike Huckabee would be kicked out of the race. He'd be dead at that point. Just the opposite happened. Huckabee got that spot, and Brownback ended up leaving the race, but he has had this personal appeal to people that Romney has not been able to make, and I think that's the bottom-up part of your theory is a lot of it.
Can I ask one more question, and that is, as conservatives look at this, I'm not the first to point this out, there's a kind of panic that if Huckabee actually can continue to gain momentum, that he would be a very weak candidate against whomever the Democrats are likely to. Is that something you share? Your own magazine has endorsed Romney.
Right. And there has been a lot of a writer at National Review dubbed Huckabashing at National Review. Basically, I mean, a lot of it started with the Club for Growth making a pretty aggressive critique of his economic and tax record in Arkansas. Then, as he's risen in the polls and he's made more statements about foreign affairs, particularly this article in the journal Foreign Affairs, which came out this week, he's been attacked as naive and unprepared as well. This is the article that said the George W. Bush administration had an arrogant bunker mentality.
And there's also the issue of him having, on the one hand, said we should have sympathy for the children of illegal immigrants and subsidize their education. So on the other hand, he's put out a very draconian immigration policy that has won the support of the Minutemen. So it's sort of...
As a matter of fact, I was out there last week, and on I believe, Tuesday of last week, he had planned a full day of activities with Jim Gilchrist, the head of the Minutemen, who had endorsed him. And it was blown out by the ice storm. I got there that night and talked to him that evening. But I asked Gilchrist, why did you choose to endorse Huckabee? Because, you know, Huckabee had done this thing in Arkansas, giving in-state tuition to the children of illegal immigrants. And Gilchrist explained to me that he had sent out this long questionnaire by registered mail to all of the candidates. And Huckabee was the only guy who returned it. And that was like 90% of the reason why he ended up endorsing Huckabee. But you're right; Huckabee has kind of played both sides on that.
So your view is still that should Huckabee win, he would be a weaker candidate than some of the others.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
I think so too. I think you guys are right.
I think
that
in a national race,
it would be the most formidable candidate.
I think in a national race against Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, I think John McCain, I think Rudy Giuliani, and even Mitt Romney, who I think would be slightly weaker than those two, but they would all be far stronger
right.
than Huckabee.
So liberals should be rooting for Huckabee. That's what I would
I think you have been rooting for Huckabee because he is giving heartburn to some elements of the conservative coalition. I think you probably enjoy
Okay, well, let's flip it now, Byron. And who should conservatives be rooting for? We've got a wide open race on the Democratic side.
Yeah. Well, conservatives actually, there have been a number of conservatives who've actually tried to consider, okay, if Republicans are really dead this year and it's going to be one of the Democrats, who would actually be best in terms of actually what's good for the country?
Mm-hmm.
And a number of the more foreign policy-minded ones have thought that Hillary Clinton would be more tough-minded than Barack Obama and would probably be a better president for national security purposes than Barack Obama would. Now, in terms of who would conservatives root for, you know, electorally, who would be best? I'm getting, you know, my conventional wisdom is shifting with the other conventional wisdom. I mean, there seems to be something terrible that's happened to the Clinton campaign in the past few weeks. And Obama, you know, there was this moment a couple of weeks ago. Obama released a TV commercial. I think it was called Our Moment or Our Moment Is Now or something like that. And it was a condensation of the speech that he gave at the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner in Des Moines. And which I thought was an okay speech. I wasn't as gaga over it as some observers, but it was a good speech. But when you took just the best parts of it and you put swelling music underneath it, you know, you look at it and say, this guy's going to win. This is very, very good. This appeal of, I do not want to spend the next 8 years refighting the battles of the 1990s. And it's a very effective ad. And I think that it's somehow there has been this shift in Iowa, maybe not as much in New Hampshire, but there's been this shift in Iowa about her. And then it's been really hurt, I think, by these I guess you'd just call them smears that the Clinton campaign has been throwing Obama's way. The Mark Penn, oh, we're not going to talk about cocaine, you know, we're not going to talk about all that blow he did, and the really kind of bewildering one from
Bob Kerry,
who while endorsing Hillary Clinton starts talking about
the secular madrasas,
Obama's ties to the Muslim world and the secular madrasas. I mean, what do you think?
Just to explain to the audience, Bob Kerry was, I think you did explain it, that he was saying, in effect, I think it would be...
He was endorsing
Hillary Clinton, but he's saying, look, the fact that he had a Muslim father and a Muslim grandfather and a middle name Hussein will make
Hussein.
Him hugely effective in making the case for America to the billion plus Muslims of this world who would not expect us to. And by the way, I think Bob Kerry, almost everything he said was quite accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been some.
Really? So you'd buy into that?
One of the things that is attractive to me and others about Obama is precisely the fact that he's got black skin and an African background and this connection with the Muslim world that he can use to this country's advantage if he were to become president. I think nothing would send a more powerful message. Unfortunately, what Bob Kerry did is provide some language that Republicans will put in ads or that will become sort of untraceable email forwards that my mom and others will be getting, and that, oh my God, he's a Muslim. And you know, I'm not of the opinion that all of this on the Hillary side was coordinated. I think obviously President Clinton is making the case that he's inexperienced and it's a roll of the dice.
Right.
Obviously, he's not he's part of the team and is doing that very deliberately. I'm not sure what Mark Penn said was a deliberate attempt to inject the word coke. I know Mark Penn. He's not that sort of good on TV. The whole if you watch the whole episode, you know, it wasn't Penn who wanted to be talking about the drug issue. He was trying to move off the drug issue, and Chris Matthews was hammering and hammering and hammering it. And eventually he said this thing, and I think he knows, and they probably know it was a mistake because it fed the whole story that, oh, they're trying to smear Obama. My God, if this is a smear, it's like one little tiny bit of mud put kind of right here, right? This has been about the cleanest campaign you can possibly imagine. And, Byron, you're out in Iowa. Do you see any ads that any Democrats are running that are in any way negative?
I should clarify, I'm in actually Washington today, but I have been out there watching TV, and no, you don't see the negative ads. They're mostly positive for both sides. And you see, by the way, it's a more than a two-person race. You see a lot of John Edwards ads, and you see a lot of Joe Biden ads. When I was out there, Joe Biden was all over the place. But let me ask you about this message. I am curious about this message that the election of Obama might send. So you have, in 2001, Muslim extremists hijack airplanes. They fly them in the World Trade Center. They bring those buildings down. They fly them in the Pentagon. They kill, in total, roughly 3,000 people. And 7 years later, we want to elect someone who has really good ties to the Muslim world to send a message that we're really nice and we don't hold it against them. I mean, what's the message that the election of Obama would send?
It seems very obvious to me. First of all, look at President Bush, who, you know, despite some mistakes of using the word crusade early on and so forth, has been consistent. This is, you know, one aspect of his otherwise regrettable administration that I think he was right about. He has struggled mightily to send a message to the Muslim world of tolerance, that we're people of the book, that we have only we want good relations. We're not seeing this as a religious clash. He immediately went to mosques after the 9/11 incidents, and so he. You know, somewhat bravely in some ways, given many in his party, has been trying to send the message that we want to be tolerant of Muslims. What I think that Barack Obama would do it's almost like putting your money down on that thought. I think it will come as a tremendous, tremendously positive shock to the system of the world, that if the American people who the rest of the world perceives as having the rest of the Muslim world perceives as having a bias against Muslims, were to choose as their president someone whose family, at least family background, is Muslim. I think.
Well, from your point of view, then it would actually be a good thing if he had been to a secular madrasa, and you could then have publicized that his middle name is Hussein and his father.
Well, look, the only reason to worry about the fact that his name is Hussein is that Republican operatives will use it to try to scare Republican and other voters into thinking the man is Muslim and is going to go soft on the Muslims and so forth. Otherwise, it is a tremendous positive tool for American foreign policy and to rebuild American trust and respect and power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
mm-hmm.
again, we're not trying to – something like this is not going to turn the minds of al-Qaeda operatives. What it's going to do is hopefully change the minds of a Muslim public in various parts of the world to thinking that America maybe isn't their enemy and that their tacit or quiet or – benign, but passive support of radical politics that in turn supports Al Qaeda will lessen, and you make the environment in which extremism thrives more hostile to that extremism.
Well, speaking of minds, it's hard to get into the mind of Bob Kerry, but so what do you think he was meaning? What do you think he meant when he talked about this secular madrasa and it'd be a great thing because of all of Obama's ties to Islam?
You know,
what was he trying to get across?
I think, you know, sometimes it's okay to take politicians at their word, and I think what he was trying to get across was what he was saying, which is, I endorse Hillary Clinton, but this is one good aspect of Barack Obama. And, you know, maybe, you know, he got into a room with a bunch of Clinton operatives and they said, look, we can't really say this, but can you say this for us? You know, people, I met Bob Kerry a couple of times and sort of followed his career, and people who know him better say the chances of him following the dictates of Clinton campaign people are about zero. So
Well, I mean, I always think, when I hear Bob Kerry and the Clintons, I always think of his great comment. I think it was an article on Esquire, and he said, you know, Bill Clinton is an unusually good liar. And then he stops for a minute and says, unusually good. So, I mean, that's kind of the most famous Bob Kerry statement.
Yeah, so this is not somebody who's a team player. and as I said, I think that there's probably got to be a general recognition in the Clinton administration, in the Hillary Clinton world, that the attacks have not worked, and that they wish some of this stuff hadn't happened. And as I said, some of it's, you know, obviously part of the strategy. Others of it my senses are not.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one last thing. You said you knew Mark Penn. Do you know David Axelrod as well?
I have interviewed David Axelrod. I was the Chicago bureau chief for U.S. News, and he was even back then in the 1990s, a pretty leading political figure, and I know people who worked for him pretty well. Mm-hmm. Mark, I know because we were both he was the pollster for Bill Clinton when I was a speechwriter there, so...
Well, I can't claim to know either one. I mean, I've stood in front of them and sort of interviewed them or asked them questions in group situation, but I just can't say. But the difference between those two guys and their sort of outer demeanor is enormous, it seems to me. And and it kind of fits the role now. Here we have Clinton as being the attack team, and with Penn and Axelrod being kind of above the fray and really quite meek, it seems, in his public demeanor.
But I think that, again, I'm not that close.
Are they really
I think
that
Penn
way?
Has been on the side of not attacking. There are others within the Clinton camp, my understanding is, who have wanted to go on the attack, and Penn has been trying to rein them in. So
it's been just kind of weird, ironic mishap that he ended up looking like the attacker.
I think so. Look, the guy is not he's not somebody who you know. He's a brilliant pollster and an able strategist, but he's not a media presence by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. All right. I think that does our presidential update today. I think we've talked about 27 minutes, and they were really
great minutes. But it's time to move on to something more fundamental,
something really kind of sexy.
Something that gets people where they live.
Right, I've been sick of all this politics and religion and all that stuff. I think we should talk about the subprime mortgage crisis. But I'm going to kind of let you start that because I know that you have some.
Well, I was very struck by the New York Times piece today on that looks at the Bush administration's record of avoiding any kind of regulatory move to rein in the subprime trend. And the piece goes back to really the 2000, 2001, the very earliest moments of the Bush administration, where this Federal Reserve member, Ed Gramlich, who was a Democrat, was the first to start saying, you know, we've got to keep our eye on the housing bubble and the, you know, use of and abuse of some of these financial innovations, and then through 2005, when Alan Greenspan was pumping up the housing bubble by saying people should turn their fixed rate mortgages into ARM mortgages that it was a very odd thing. We actually wrote about this back in 2005.
Pull money out of their houses, spend the money, and keep
exactly.
the economy.
Use your house as an ATM machine to, you know, buy cars and dinners out, and he did that at the time because the feeling was that the economy was teetering on that only consumer spending could keep us from a recession and incomes weren't going up, so better to cash out our mortgages. And all along the line, people were saying, like this woman who, Bain, I think is her name, who's now the head of the FDIC, as the subprime innovations were beginning to happen, saying, we really have to come up with a mechanism to make sure that these people can pay back their mortgages. And at every turn, Greenspan was saying, well, the Fed really shouldn't be involved because we don't have the muscle to do that, and the other regulatory agencies were saying, well, that's really not our bailiwick. From what we see, that's not a problem. And this is a kind of consistent problem in the, as you may know, in the regulation of the financial industry, that we have six or seven different organizations, agencies that regulate different parts of the financial world, and new things slip in between the cracks. This was clearly the case with subprime mortgages. What you needed was an administration that got everybody together and said, let's take these concerns seriously. And what you had was kind of the opposite. And it's a pretty devastating piece. And it made me think, frankly, of Katrina. We don't have the same, you know, massive death and destruction, but the end result is sort of the same. Millions of people are going to lose their homes because the federal government couldn't get its act together. In fact, had a policy of resisting the kinds of federal action that it would take to either keep the thing from happening or responding when it did.
Well, I think that right now you've made a shameless attempt to politicize this. I mean, you did start with the first thing you said you talked about the Bush administration's record of avoiding any regulation in this. And, you know, as I read the article, this article is, if there's a villain, and you said it was devastating, if it's devastating, it's devastating to Alan Greenspan, it seems to me. And you did say that there's been this consistent problem in the regulation of the financial industry. And, I think that you can certainly blame Bush. I think Bush had a lot more control over FEMA in the case of Katrina than Bush had over Alan Greenspan and the Fed in the case of these.
But I'm not sure the Fed should have been the lead agency here. I don't know enough to know who should have been the lead agency. But shouldn't somebody in the federal level have been the lead agency to point this out?
Well, I think at this point it would.
The Treasury Department, somebody.
But I get the impression from reading this Times article that they think that this Edmund Andrews, the reporter for the Times, thinks that the Fed should have played a role, because they sure seem to be blaming Greenspan for not playing enough of a role, and suggesting that Greenspan is darn defensive about it today when they are questioning.
Well, and I think the reason that logic comes forth is that it's the Fed now that's trying to play a role in minimizing the disaster now that it's happened, and that's all,
right.
And that's because the Fed has that ability to add liquidity and so forth. But in terms of regulating financial instruments, the Fed might have been a leader in calling attention to it, but I think that the point of the article was kind of making is lots of institutions would have had to play a role to kind of create the regulatory mechanism to do something about this. And I think that Alan Greenspan was using the excuse, but it doesn't mean the excuse isn't true, that the Fed didn't have the requisite authority or personnel on its own to
right.
do something like that. That's probably true, but it's, you know, the point is you shouldn't expect the Fed to fix this. Washington needs to fix this. The people who are in charge of regulating the financial industry should have fixed this.
Well, I still think that the only area I really disagree with you about is this idea of putting it on Bush. And God knows lots of things can be put on Bush. But it seems to me that the article, you know, really seemed to me to be more about the Fed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt that they were encouraging people, and I guess the whole height of this was 2004, right? That was kind of the peak of this stuff. They were encouraging people to get money out of their houses, keep the, you know, and to keep
right.
house prices going up, and they simply did not. Which seems astonishing in retrospect. They simply did not take into account what might happen if house prices did not continue
right,
to rise.
Right, exactly. They built their models on the assumption that housing prices would continue to rise, which is, you know, if the Washington Monthly could figure that out, that was not going to be the case in 2005, you'd think somebody at the federal level would have figured that out.
Yes.
And the other thing that comes across in this article, and you're right, I'm the one putting the political spin on it. The New York Times is, you know, actually not being liberally biased. It's putting out the facts. I get
to put
in
liberal
bias.
That's good.
The point that this woman Bain, the head of the FDIC, was making is, look, there was this concern, this issue of we want the financial industry to innovate, and it's good that more people who don't necessarily have the incomes or credits to have in the past been able to own a home, that there are mechanisms to allow them to do that. And Ed Gramlich was saying that's a good thing, too. But you have to balance innovation with regulations that make sure that we're not taking too many risks. And what the Bush administration seems to have done is weighed everything on the innovation side and feared that any kind of regulation would have crushed the innovation, therefore we shouldn't do it.
But, I mean, people were basically thinking home ownership is good. Home ownership rates went from, 64%?
69%, I think, something like that.
Close to 70%, that's right. And so everybody was saying that's really, really good. And, look, I can't speak with any great expertise on this, but it seems to be... by the way, were there... and I'm actually asking this a question because I don't know the answer. Were there crusaders, people who were trying to sound the alarm on Capitol Hill about this at the time?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know. I know there were people championing the need to regulate more heavily. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and so forth. Those groups, but I have to say, in all fairness, there were as many Republicans as Democrats in the small minority of people who cared about this. And Democrats are all wrapped up in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. They get good jobs there and so forth. So,
boy, do they. It's a fantastic
place. It sure is. You got that beautiful office building on Wisconsin Avenue and... you work your 9-to-5 better than what we've got. I'll say that.
And you take millions. And I mean, if you look at the compensation of Franklin Raines and Jamie Gorelick, the compensation was off the scale.
Well, yeah, they're federally chartered private entities, so the civil service requirements on pay don't apply. Well, so I'll leave it at this. I think that if we go into a recession in the spring. And I think that the amount of foreclosures is going to increase considerably between now and the spring. And if that sends us into a recession because of the attendant problems with the financial markets, that a lot more people than I will be pointing the finger at George Bush as having failed on his regulatory duties.
You're absolutely right. The president will get the blame if the economy slips into a recession. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And... he'll also get the blame if Afghanistan sinks into a dysfunctional, failed terrorist state, which is where you think it's going.
Well, it's not just me. Apparently, the last couple of Sunday in the New York Times and Monday in the Washington Post, there were front-page reports that the Bush administration suddenly recognized what many... In the military and the State Department have been telling them for months, which is the resurgence of the Taliban and the weakness of the Karzai government and the failure of the NATO allies to put in place policies and the Karzai government put in place policies that put infrastructure and government functioning into the dispersed rural Afghanistan means that country, that the security there is going down, not up. And so the Nick Burns, the Undersecretary of State, is doing a government-wide reassessment of our force posture there. There is talk that there's pressure on the White House to shift more troops out of Iraq and put them into Afghanistan. Now that things are a little quieter in Iraq, they think maybe we can afford to make this shift. And so this is now the issue of the day in Washington in the national security circles.
Now, let me ask you this. In the 2004 campaign, I remember John Kerry made a fairly big deal that the United States had taken its eye off the ball in going into
Correct.
Iraq, and that we should have stayed... kept our focus going on Afghanistan. I take it you agree with that?
I completely agree with that.
Yeah. The only question I have is, what if, instead of going into Iraq, George Bush had decided to focus exclusively on Afghanistan, he wasn't content with just toppling the Taliban, he had sent a lot more troops into Afghanistan in a determined, measured effort to just wipe out al-Qaeda completely, certainly to get bin Laden, which he should have done. Somehow bin Laden remains in hiding. resentments against the presence of American troops grow. There's an insurgency. There are suicide bombers. There are improvised explosive devices. I know we have these things going on in Afghanistan, but if they were going on at a much greater level, U.S. deaths began to rise. Do you think that Democrats would still be supporting the president's decision to escalate a war in Afghanistan?
Well, I think there's about three hypotheticals there. I mean, I don't think anyone was calling for troop levels of you know, massive proportions. I think that the idea of sending in, you know, 20, 30,000 more troops to finish off, to close off, we wouldn't even, frankly, have needed that much to close off Tora Bora and to get bin Laden and his 2,000 fighters. Had we simply done that, we'd been in far, far better shape in the region than we are now. You know, more troops are certainly needed, but what has been needed in Afghanistan for a long time is some kind of policy to rebuild the country, to create infrastructure projects in these far-flung villages, to connect the villages to Kabul instead of and trying to kind of knit that country together as it was much more so 20, 25 years ago before the civil wars and so forth, the fight against the Soviets. So it's not so much a massive military presence that has ever been needed. It is a soft power development presence that's been needed. And we have a story in the current issue of the Washington Monthly about a program called the National Solidarity Project, which is run by the World Bank, that does precisely that. And it's been up and running. It's something that started actually a World Bank project in Indonesia that worked very well there, and it was tried elsewhere and worked. And now, since 2001, it's been up and running in Afghanistan. And what it does is it's the World Bank provides funds to the Kabul government, to the Afghan government, which then breaks up this money into loans, into grants for villages, provided the villages put together representative committees of citizens that have to vote on what projects they want, and provided that they get some training on accounting and transparency, and provided that they post the funding levels and the disbursements there in the village so everybody can kind of follow what's going on. And there have been a number of evaluations of this program, and what it has shown pretty consistently is, even in the most backwater, dangerous parts of Afghanistan where the Taliban is powerful, these are the projects the Taliban won't torch. These are the projects the villagers within reason will defend. These are the projects that continue to be built even when the NGOs can't go into a region or the NATO troops are getting attacked. These little wells and medical you know, clinics and little hydroelectric power plants that power electricity for 300 families, these things are continuing to be built, and it's creating a kind of local kind of democracy, the beginnings of democracy. It's connecting those villagers with Kabul, and it's showing them that there's some hope for Afghanistan beyond the Taliban and endless war. And the tragedy is that the Bush administration, when Paul Wolfowitz was at the World Bank, knew about this program and consciously didn't ask for money to fund it, and in the last budget actually cut the U.S. contribution to this program. So, you know, there are things out there that we could be doing in addition to shoring up the troops levels, but you'd have to have somebody in charge who knew what they were doing, and we apparently don't right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, much of this has been sort of outsourced to NATO at this point, even though the United States is by far the biggest supplier of forces there, right?
Well, that's right. The United States brought in NATO about 6 or 8 months after the beginning of hostilities there, and NATO has been a presence. And in fact, it's NATO troops that are fighting the Taliban much more so than the U.S. troops. U.S. troops are, I believe, in the east, where the actual fighting with the Taliban is going on mostly, I guess, in the south. I don't know the country personally, I've never been there, but so it's Canadians and Australians that are taking the bullets.
Do you think there's a policy that we could have followed after the toppling of the Taliban that would have resulted in the country being pretty stable and not needing all that much tender loving care?
No, I think it would have required tender loving care for years, but I think you could have had a policy that would have provided a lot more stability, a lot more growth, a lot more, a lot fewer Taliban. Had you brought in NATO early, had you not invaded Afghanistan, had you had the Europeans been had the Europeans seen Afghanistan as their way of becoming. Look, you know, the Europeans felt great about what they did in Kosovo. Even the U.S. provided 80% of the sorties. The Europeans had a war, which they fought and won, and they felt great about that. And remember, the French put on the front page of Le Monde after 9/11, they said, "We are all Americans." The Europeans were with us after 9/11. And
so we could have done the same thing, got them online, on board, fought the war for them, and then they could feel really great.
Well,
they
would be fighting they would be putting ground troops in as they have now. My guess is they would have been willing to put more ground troops in. But the truth of the matter is, we've got a military of such outlandish size compared to everyone else that in any allied endeavor, we're gonna do the lion's share of the work.
You're not saying our military is too small? It's too big, are you?
No. As a matter of fact, I think, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, we'd have more forces to deploy because I think the world needs it. I think that's,
I
don't think that's possible right now. I think, in fact, the size of our forces are more likely to shrink than grow, and that actually, Byron, you provide a nice segue to what is our cover story this month by Andrew Tillman, and it's a piece about the alarming exodus of junior officers from the Army. I didn't realize this, but I do now that we've published the story. 58% of the West Point class of, I think it's 2001, maybe 2002, has resigned from the Army. These are the folks who would eventually be promoted to major and colonel and general and 20 years from now, four-star generals. And these folks are leaving the military in near record numbers. And it's not... There are a lot of reasons for that.
So in other words, immediately after, when you graduate from West Point, you have an obligation to serve.
That's right, 5 years.
You're saying immediately after serving that minimum or obligation.
They're out of more than half.
What was the rate 10 years ago?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they've struggled. This is an interesting story because it's Iraq is part of it, but it's also one of the weaknesses of the all-volunteer force. And it's kind of complicated by the fact that you had a great drawdown in the size of the forces in the 90s. So they were trying to actually shed junior officers back then.
But I'm asking you here, do you know what the rate was, say, 10 years ago?
I don't know precisely what the rate was precisely 10 years ago.
Was it roughly similar to what it is now?
It was roughly similar. In fact, the worst year for the exodus was not this year, but sometime in the 90s. I don't know exactly what the year was. But the complicating factor there was it was something the Army was engineering itself. This is something the Army is trying desperately not to happen.
So do you do not report this story in the context of the Iraq War?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the Iraq War makes it much worse.
But if it was the same 10 years ago, what's the deal?
Well, there are two things. First of all, because you have an all-volunteer force, and you're trying, if your aim is to get the best and the brightest young officers, those officers are working in a military culture where their wives are in, you know, their families are in little towns in West Texas and the South and rural areas, away from the big cities where a lot of these spouses would like to live in order to practice their professions. There's good jobs for a well-trained, highly skilled junior officer. So there's a lot of competition for these folks, for these young men, and especially in the 90s when the Army didn't seem like the place to be, they were having a tough time retaining their best and brightest. What happened is actually the Iraq War helped for a while in retention because for the first time these young officers were getting a chance to utilize their skills.
And September 11th.
And September 11th, absolutely. That suddenly they were at the center of the patriotic effort of this country, and they could feel, you know, triply great about the careers that they chose. What's happened now is after the third or fourth deployment, or in some cases we're getting to the fifth deployment of these young officers, a couple of deployments they feel good about what they're doing, but if the deployments continue, they start looking and saying, you know, for as long as my career is going to be, I'm going to have a career in the military, I'm going to be away from my family every 15 months out of every 2 years. I got a wife who's miserable. I'm not seeing my kids. Frankly, a lot of these junior officers very early on lost faith in the military leadership. So they're leaving in droves, and they're, as long as we retain a big deployment in Iraq and also Afghanistan, it's very hard to put into place policies that you can help retain these officers. What they need is a break from the deployment schedules. They need to be able to plop their family down in a safe location where they can be for a number of years and know that they're going to be there. Well, we can't afford that. We have to have these guys over there fighting.
Well, I'm not disagreeing that that is the reason now, but I mean, if you have a story where alarmingly high numbers are leaving after fulfilling their obligation 10 years ago for one set of reasons, and a similarly alarming number are leaving after their obligation now for a different set of reasons, it seems to me that, yes, the Iraq War has been a huge strain on military families, but there have been systemic problems.
Absolutely.
With a volunteer
That's
army.
Right.
And here again, I want to warn you against shamelessly politicizing these things. Here again, this is an issue that has persisted over the years.
It has not persisted so much over the years because the conditions keep changing. As I said, in the 90s, it was the Army itself that was shedding junior officers. Now the Army is trying to retain junior officers. So it's a very different problem. Nevertheless, as we report in the piece, and I don't see why this is shamelessly politicizing it, we reported it precisely as it is. The condition that young officers work under today is different than the conditions young officers worked 20, 30 years ago when the all-volunteer force was first put into effect. Back then, the wives were happy teaching school in Killeen, Texas. Back then, a foreign deployment meant Germany, right, where you could, you know, be with your family and get in the Mercedes-Benz and go touring, France on the weekends. Today, a foreign deployment means you're away from your family and they don't know if you're going to come back dead or alive.
Right. You're in a dangerous, awful place where there's a war. I mean, that's part of that's part of the problem.
Right. And if it were a war of short duration where you get to utilize your skills and come back victorious, that's going to be helpful to retaining these young officers. But if you're in a war without end where you're going to have 100,000 troops in Iraq for the next 20 years, that is going to almost certainly decimate, more than decimate, because decimate is just cut by 10%. You're going to destroy the officer corps. And it's this officer corps from whom we're going to be picking 3- and 4-star generals 15, 20 years from now.
Our viewers will correct us, but isn't decimated cutting to a tenth of the former?
I thought it was cutting by one-tenth.
Right. I think it's the other way around. I think it's cutting to a tenth, like cutting 90% of it. So decimated means it's really, really devastated.
But I think you're wrong, but
our
commenters on Blogging Heads TV will correct us.
Can we go on? Our last subject, actually, today is this debate that has been... It's a spinoff on the debate over the destruction of videotapes of CIA interrogations, but it's this, the case of this guy, Abu Zubaydah.
Right.
who was
the logistics guy for Al Qaeda.
Is the logistics mastermind of Al Qaeda, or is, in the words of a Washington Post story today, citing some FBI analysts and agents, a quote, a loudmouth and mentally troubled hotelier.
Right.
By that, I apparently read down in the story, he operated a safe
right.
house for, I guess, his terrorist friends. It strikes me, there are a couple of things about it. There's a debate between the CIA and the FBI about how effective or how useful the information that Abu Zubaydah gave was. And then there's a debate about under what circumstances he gave the useful information. The CIA basically says he was really useful. The information was really useful, and he gave it, frankly, after we waterboarded
right.
him. And the FBI said he didn't have that much to say. But then, kind of paradoxically, some of them say, "Well, he gave a lot, you know, some pretty good stuff before, you know, when we were, when he was not being subjected to these aggressive interrogation techniques." A couple of things. One, I would recommend that all of our viewers watch or read the transcript of the interview, ABC News Brian Ross interview with the former CIA operative
Kiriakou.
Kiriakou took part not in the waterboarding of Zubaydah, but in the initial discussions and interrogations of him. Describes a very, very long process in which Zubaydah is questioned, and then every escalation in the questioning of him, everything they do that's a little more aggressive than before, is painstakingly cleared at the highest levels of the CIA in Washington, and finally they do go to waterboarding. And in Kiriakou's view, this breaks Abu Zubaydah, and then he gives valuable information. And by valuable information, Kiriakou means information that helped Americans stop terrorist attacks, that literally saved
right.
lives. And even though Kiriakou now says that he's kind of changed his mind about waterboarding and he really thinks that we shouldn't be in the business of doing it, he was asked by Brian Ross, did it work? And he says, yes. And then he said, you know, if there were a threat to a city or something today, I couldn't live with myself if we didn't do it. So it's a very mixed picture that you get. And so two things strike me from this. One, you have this testimony that it actually worked. And two, it appears that waterboarding was used on a very, very small number of people, maybe like one hand or less. And it was done in the period, in the months after September 11th, mostly in 2002, in which the sort of sort of ticking time bomb scenario was actually kind of real, because people were very, very afraid that more terrorist attacks were on the way. So this debate over whether Abu Zubaydah was a terrorist mastermind or loudmouth and mentally troubled hotelier, I think obscures a little bit this idea that yes, our policy is to not torture. But in extraordinary situations, a couple of times, we waterboarded these guys. It was very, very useful, and we told Congress about it. So I frankly am not all that upset. My guess is
I disagree pretty profoundly. First of all, Kiriakou, by his own admission, was not around when the waterboarding happened.
That's right. We should say, though, that he actually had been personally waterboarded as part of
right.
his training.
As are most special forces and so forth. But the difference is they know that they're going through training. They don't actually
right.
aren't being actually tortured. So Kiriakou, by his own admission, was not around for the waterboarding. What he heard, what he knows, is what he heard from his friends who did it, who were there. I guess presumably his friends were. It may be friends who. People who were.
I mean, he was still at the CIA.
He was still CIA, but
he was not. He said he read a lot of the cable traffic.
Well, lots
about
of people read a lot of the cable traffic. The FBI was reading the cable traffic. But the point is, Kiriakou was not in a position to know firsthand whether the waterboarding worked. Mm-hmm. Second, the way this is not an academic debate. This is not a theoretical debate. This is one that can be proven with evidence. Right? We can look at the tapes. And see, did Abu Zubaydah give us... Oh, we can't look at the tapes, because they destroyed them. Ha! Isn't that convenient?
Well, I'm sure there's other evidence.
Well, apparently there are no transcripts.
Did
they didn't even make transcripts. They made memos of the thing.
They made memos every day.
And so, look,
which is much like if you're interviewed by the FBI today, as we saw in the Scooter Libby trial, for example, you're questioned by FBI agents who are sitting there with a pen and paper writing down notes. And those are used in court, and we convict people based on that kind of stuff. So there
in this case,
are
you actually
records.
Have taped transcript, taped tapes. So
yes.
You could easily have made transcripts of them. They chose not to do it. Look, we still don't have any hard evidence. And I'm not saying that you couldn't that such evidence wasn't there. I'm saying if there is hard evidence that what Abu Zubaydah said resulted in some intelligence coups that were of real value, let's hear it. I've not really seen it. Now, in this New York Times piece, they on that side of the ledger, they say that in the 9/11 Commission reports that Abu Zubaydah during the time period. Which we now know they were using some of these torture techniques, did finger another guy who was also then waterboarded, who then gave up a name or something. So there's at least some circumstantial evidence that under duress, under torture, Zubaydah gave valuable information. But that's all we have.
Some publicly available circumstantial
evidence. Right, and
presumably there's more evidence.
Don't we have it? I mean, this administration has not been chary about pulling out those bits of evidence that can support their case, and we've not heard it. In fact, John McLaughlin, the interim head of the CIA, was on the Diane Rehm show a couple of months ago, and was asked specifically, did the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah lead to intelligence that saved people's lives? And the way he phrased his response, it was clear he didn't want to have to say yes. He said, mm-hmm. We did do enhanced interrogation techniques, we believe they're valuable, and we did get valuable intelligence from Abu Zubaydah. What he wouldn't say was, because of the torture techniques, we got valuable intelligence. Frankly, I don't mm-hmm. think they did, or we'd know about mm-hmm. it. And that is consistent with the majority view of people in the business of interrogating dangerous people, which is that you get more noise than you get clarity. That mm-hmm. they throw out a lot of BS that you have to then go track down, that you're much more likely to get valuable information through other means than through torture. And mm-hmm. that is, my friend, the predominant view in the national security establishment. The minority view, the very much minority view for decades, is you should do things like waterboarding. And it is incumbent upon those who believe in waterboarding to give us a scintilla of evidence that it's worked.
Well, first of all, this is a kind of debate. This is like the debate over warrantless wiretapping. We're doing it in the dark because there's a lot of stuff we don't.
Well, I'm all for opening it up. And
it's at some point I think we would have to open this up. I think that. Yeah, I wrote a column for The Hill, I think, last week, and I talked about a dinner I had about a year ago with someone who had been involved in the U.S. War on Terror, and we were talking about allegations of torture, and he basically said, you know, what I can't understand is our policy should always be that we do not torture, and we should abide by that policy, and if there is some extremely extraordinary situation in a very limited way, we will violate our policy and we'll explain what we did and we'll move on. The thing I can't figure out is why lawmakers want to try to make laws that will deal with any and all situations that may come up in the
future.
Well,
I think the answer is that a blanket policy of no torture so strengthens your position, so controls the rogue elements, so is so necessary in conducting yourself in the world, that poking loopholes in it is ill-advised. And the real question that I have is...
But the problem is I sense in your argument that if I could say, you know something, Paul, I actually have the evidence right here, the waterboarding in these two situations did actually work, and this were actually unquestioned evidence, then I'm wondering if you would say, well, okay, maybe that... In those circumstances, it would have been all right.
Well, look, published, Phil Carter published a piece in the Washington Monthly back in 2003 that made pretty much the argument your friend at the dinner party made. His argument was that in very narrow circumstances, if I remember his argument, very narrow circumstances, when a president specifically approves it, that you ought to be allowed to use these techniques. And I published that piece, so I'm open to the, it's not that I'm not open to the argument. I guess that, you know, let me kind of make a baseball metaphor. It is kind of an iron rule in baseball that, you know, you use a left-handed pitcher against a right-handed batter. It's not that a right-handed batter can never hit a left-handed pitcher's balls out of the park. It's that on balance over time, the probability is you'll win. So the argument, I think, would be not that sometimes with torture you don't get some valuable information, but that over time the way you get the most information is through other means. And the damage of torture is such that you just shouldn't go there.
I'm not saying I disagree with that. I do think it's important when looking at the Kiriakou stuff to go back to those early months of 2002, and I believe we captured Ebu Zubaydah in March of 2002. And you did almost have a kind of 24-like sense that there was an imminent attack. I know I was certainly afraid that there was going to be some other big attack.
Yeah.
People in the U.S. government who knew a lot more than I did were certainly very, very worried about it. So you did have that kind of situation in which they made the decision.
And I'm very sympathetic to people. I'm very sympathetic to civil servants in these enormously high-pressure situations having to make judgments about what they need to do to keep an imminent attack. I'm enormously sympathetic. And we can have a debate about what you do under those circumstances. What I don't understand is, you know, years after that, you're still defending a broad policy of torture. You're still defending, the administration is defending a broad policy of torture. They're defending presidential authority to torture. They're wanting to cover all of this stuff up. And 3 years later, when under strict orders from the courts and elsewhere not to destroy the evidence of these torture events, the CIA goes ahead and destroys it anyway. You can make it. There are several issues here. The one issue, and the narrow one that I think you're bringing up, is: are there not circumstances whereby we want to free up our intelligence service to torture,
where we violate our own policy?
Right. And then there's the I think I don't think I hear you defending the need the decision to destroy the evidence of that torture.
You do not hear me defending.
Yeah. So, on your point, I used to be a little bit more persuadable than I am now, but I'll keep my mind vaguely open.
My renewed point is coming from reading the transcript of the Kiriakou interview, like you, I would love to know actual facts about this because I realize there are people who say Kiriakou is wrong. I'm not sure how far further we can go.
No, it seems like our disagreement is not as profound, but in the end, profound enough.
Yeah. All right. I think
have we logged in our full hour here? We don't.
My God, I think we're now at 68 minutes.
Oh, we get a bonus for going over an hour, don't we?
You know, I think you're right. You know, now High Noon was only High Noon was about 7.
That's right.
Minutes.
That's right. And this was least as good as High Noon.
At least. And it'll receive just as many plays.
Absolutely.
I'm sure. But, you know, with the writer's strike, I'm worried about us getting benefits from digital reproduction.
Well, we'll have to talk to Bob about that.
That is another issue. So, anyway, it was I greatly
Same
enjoyed
here.
It.
Same
and,
here.
Let's do it
Merry
again
Christmas.
Soon. And I think we'll. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to all. And we will talk
Take
later.
Take care, Byron.
Bye-bye.